welcome back to Firewall. As usual, I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. With me today is Webb Smith. And for those of you who don't know the name, he's the guy. So when you ask who is the expert in e-commerce, in direct-to-consumer, in retail brands, it's him. And I don't even know how we got connected to him, but someone said they knew him, and we jumped all over them and said, can we get him on the podcast? And luckily, he said yes. So, Webb, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, for the listeners who don't know you, you know, how do you become like America's guru on D2C and e-com?
Well, I think the first step is to not think that you're a guru. I certainly don't. I think that I would probably position myself as a perpetual learner. I spend a lot of time researching. I actually go through a lot of the writing processes as someone that's research-minded. And so I try to maintain a position as a student of the industry rather than someone that's a purported expert. But if I come across that way and I do get things right from time to time, I'm not mad about that either.
And like, how'd you decide to kind of do all this? I mean, you've done so many different companies, you know, you're a founder of multiple things, expert. Like, did you kind of always know, like, hey, I'm really interested in kind of direct-to-consumer trends? And are you, I don't even know how old you are. Are you a digital native? I assume you're not, which means what were you interested in before e-commerce was a thing?
Well, that's a great question. I've actually been in e-commerce the majority of my career. I'm 37 years old, father of two. I feel a lot older than most 37-year-olds, but I'd like to think that I was youthful. I would consider myself a digitally native. Listen, I started 2PM because, frankly, in 2015, I found that every single publication tried to find their politics angle because it was driving clicks and engagement. And I really just wanted to focus on a place where I could get better at my craft. I found myself in an operational role, losing sight of my abilities, and I wanted to be able to practice that in a place that was devoid of any conversations as it related to the Trump presidency or the Clinton campaign or anything like that. And ironically, it sort of spun out into an e-commerce platform driven by the study of sociology, which I didn't expect, but that's just how it evolved.
Given that we've been in this sort of, you know, global pandemic and quarantine for, I don't know, month seven now or eight, something like that, how have you been thinking about it? Like, what changes and trends are permanent? What are just kind of pandemic only? And is there kind of like, what's the broader intellectual framework you're using to even kind of figure out what you think about all this stuff?
I would start with the framework. So China's always been a leading indicator for what America's going to do with regards to e-commerce, especially over the last 15 to 20 years. If you look at the 2003 SARS epidemic, they went from, you know, trailing the United States by a factor of five to completely dominating us in e-commerce penetration just 3 years afterwards. That was driven by their e-commerce adjustments in 2003. They wanted to build a B2B and B2C peer system where they could sell without having to be in markets. And that sort of spawned the hyper growth of Alibaba. Here, I think we saw that in the spring and the summer, e-commerce penetration exploded. People would tend to say, oh, it's going to go back to normal, but it's not. I mean, it's certainly going to trail off as people visit stores for the first time in a long time. But in the scheme of things, we are becoming an e-commerce economy, whether we like it or not.
And do you think kind of COVID took what was inevitable and just kind of made it happen even faster? and do a lot of the kind of brick and mortar places that have closed over the last 6 months, do they bounce back? And I know this is a controversial question to ask, but should they bounce back?
No, they shouldn't bounce back. And I don't think that they will bounce back unless they have some private equity magic that I have yet to see. You know, I know that companies like Brookfield and I want to say Simon Property Group and Authentic Brands Group, they're investing in these companies. I think that they're investing in toxic assets, but you know, that's a story for 2008. I'll let the experts do what they do. I just don't see how they're going to pull the rabbit out of the hat, frankly. These are companies that are poorly merchandised and that have lost the interest of a lot of consumers today. So I'm really anxious to see how they plan on actually, optimizing for growth here. Listen, I think that overall malls are struggling. I've long said that we are over retailed by about double what we see in Europe and about 30% what we see in Canada. 30% more and 50% more.
Relatively. We should have. Yeah.
Yeah. And, we have to level out. And if you look at anything across the board in China with 30% plus e-commerce penetration as a percent of retail, their storefronts are a quarter of ours. So something has to give. And what we're watching is that something giving.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there, I guess their counter would be, well, people want experiences, especially millennials, and everyone is sick of being stuck at home. And therefore, if a mall can offer something really special, people are going to come. And then when they're there, they're going to shop and spend money. Why doesn't that argument work for you?
Yeah, I think that argument is based on the reality of a strong middle class. And I don't think that we have that anymore. I think that we have a bifurcating economy where the middle class and the upper middle class are either getting richer or they're falling into the working class. The mall structure that we all know and love is built around middle class shoppers. I'm not saying that malls are going to die or that millennials and Generation Z folks don't love malls. What I'm saying is that a lot of the companies that are dying right now are companies that were specifically tailored to go after the middle class. So you're not seeing a problem at the Apple Store or Lululemon or Lilly Pulitzer or you name it. These are stores that are typically held strongly as upper middle class to wealth class shops. But you're seeing it at Macy's, at JCPenney, at Dillard's, even at Neiman Marcus, and that's going to continue.
And so the D2C brands that get a lot of attention in kind of the world that you and I live in the kind of venture and startup world tend to be focused on those higher end consumers. Is that because that's where the money is, or is it because that's where all of us kind of live as well? And are people kind of going after, you know, much more of the working class, you know, through e-commerce? And if so, who's succeeding?
It's a great question. Listen, I think this is sort of where it intersects with your arena. E-commerce is quite literally a luxury product in America. We were at 11.9% penetration in Q4 of 2019. If you look at the vast majority of folks that have Amazon Prime accounts, keep in mind this is outside of New York. So I know that salaries are a little bit different there. But I think the vast majority, I want to say something above 85 to 90% had an average take-home income of $100,000 or more. And so e-commerce is an upper middle class product. And so if you're going after brands that are online, you're typically going after that upper middle class person. I think that a lot of these brands are founded by New York and LA natives or people that went to school there and decided to start companies there. And so naturally, you're going to find more of those consumers in those circles. I think that as e-commerce continues to grow, it will become a middle-class product, but that's probably 2 to 5 years down the line.
And do you see particular retailers looking at kind of the middle working class? Like for example, Walmart. What do you think of their e-commerce efforts? And do you think that they're maybe among the first to start capturing the non kind of luxury product version of e-commerce?
Yeah, I think Walmart's in a great position. Listen, Walmart's always been the darling of the working class, and they have continued to do that. I know that in the press, when you see Andy Dunn and Mark Lurie and all these folks, yep, they give off this aura of you know, stature. But you know, I live in Columbus, Ohio. When you know, I go out to the suburbs, the middle class, the lower middle class suburbs, where all the Walmarts are, and I walk through those stores, there's nothing Andy Dunn about those stores. Okay. So, yeah, have fun, you know, not wearing nice watches in that Walmart, not to be stuffy or anything, but like that's what it's like in the Midwest and that's what it's like in the South.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think Walmart's done a magnificent job of holding firm to that, I guess you can call it electorate or consumer, but also pursuing initiatives, whether failed or successful, that go up market in ways. They tried with Andy Dunn's approach. It didn't exactly work, though he certainly had an impact on the company in the long term.
Yep.
And now they're doing Walmart Plus, which is their attempt to go up market again. And that's apparently working really well. Over the years, you've seen the Walmart brand sort of shift in the public narrative from working class because no one goes into the stores to, hey, this is a retail slash technology based company. Mm-hmm. And they're going to continue to do that.
And who are Amazon's customers ultimately? Is it that kind of luxury class, or have they penetrated working class too?
I think luxury might be a stretch. I would just say upper middle class and up would be my best guess. If you're buying things online and you can do away with $6, $12 shipping here or there, or you're having products delivered to your house in 4 hours for like a 15% premium, what most people don't really realize is that you have to be sort of well off to be comfortable with that, right? For the vast majority of America, if you're paying $20 more for something delivered to your house, that's a no-go, right? Right. It's probably going to sound wild to a lot of people listening to this, but yeah. I try to listen to those consumers quite a bit, and it's a lot easier here in the Midwest to do that. And that's one of the reasons why e-commerce hasn't really fallen, because logistics is still a costly proposition.
What do you think COVID will end up doing to kind of trends of where people are living? So for example, I live in Manhattan, and there's at least a narrative of people moving out like crazy to the suburbs or to rural areas or something else like that. Do you think that there will be a deurbanization? And if so, what does that mean for e-commerce?
So I have dueling thoughts, and maybe you can help me out here. So my first thought when I wrote about this originally was, when the malls crash, and they are, it will begin to have an impact on the residential real estate prices of the suburbs, especially the middle class ones, not the upper class ones, but the ones that have the tier B, tier C malls. When I had a conversation with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, he sort of rearranged my thoughts a little bit. He said, with fewer amenities in urban areas, there's less of a reason to live in the city. If we're doing business by e-commerce, if we're working from home, if we are distance learning and all these things, at the very least, we're going to want space. And I think if you look at any Zillow data, any real estate data, they're going to show you that the cost of suburban homes have gone up. The cost of urban homes in most cities have stayed steady. The cost of urban homes in New York, LA, San Francisco, and a few others have dwindled. And I think that that's pretty consistent with those thoughts.
And do you think, I worry as a New Yorker that COVID in many ways is the kind of office space equivalent of that aha moment in the second half of the 20th century when manufacturers in the U.S. realized that they could make the same products abroad for, roughly equivalent quality and at a fraction of the cost. And kind of once they realized that, there was no real turning back, right? It might have kind of happened over a course of decades, but still, it collapsed a lot of tax bases in cities from within. And I always have this fear that, COVID said to a lot of employers, productivity is kind of the same thing, people working remotely, and the technology is pretty good, and we can do it a lot cheaper. And once they realize that, there's kind of the no going back equivalent. Do you think there's going to be a hollowing out of kind of office jobs in cities like New York, LA, San Francisco? And if so, is there a reason to think that those cities will do better long term than a Baltimore, or Cleveland, or Detroit did when manufacturing left?
It's a really good question. I don't know if I'm as doom and gloom on New York as some people are. I was just there a few days ago. I still love the city. I still had a wonderful time with friends. It's clearly going to be impacted by the departure from in-office work. I was around the Hudson Yards development. You can look in the offices at night and see not a soul there. You can look in the offices in the day and see not a soul there. I don't know what they're going to do with all that office space. I don't know what they're going to do as they redevelop large anchors into more office space. So in that context, I guess the verdict is sort of out. It's going to be harder. Now, there's an idea that I've written about in the past called sanitized urbanization. It's actually something that I'm taking part of myself. One of the first things I did during COVID was buy property in like the nicest area of Columbus, Ohio. And I was like, hey, listen, if this continues and I'm no longer gaining, my property is no longer appreciating in the city, then it's time to go.
Right.
And so I think that you're going to see a lot of a lot of people moving to ex-urban areas that resemble downtown sort of activity. There are a lot of those developments in places like Atlanta and Columbus and Cleveland, you name it. As it relates to New York, San Francisco, LA, and all those, listen, I've always been in Columbus. I've been in Columbus for the majority of my career. In 2019, I flew to New York 50 times. I flew to LA 20 times. You know, I personally believe that you can live in a place like this and still do business just as well in those cities. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people will start to think that way as well.
So the people who, I guess, disagree with the concern that you and I seem to share would say, well, young people want to be with young people. Creative people want to be with creative people. The kind of richer Floridization theory that all of that energy kind of drives itself. And therefore, employers will have to be in New York and LA because their employees will demand it. Do you buy that?
I would like to see those employers demand staying in New York, LA, or San Francisco. I just don't see it happening. You know, listen, as you stay in those areas, the cost of doing business grows for those individuals. They're having to travel further to get the same materials and the groceries and the food and the supplies that they need for their homes, because a lot of the stores aren't open, and we don't know when that's going to return. Also, we're failing to think about what's going to happen if and when the second wave occurs, and what impact that has on closures, on office availability. You know, I'm not saying we're going to go back to the spring, but it's quite possible that we're going to see something like it. And I think that second effort will leave a long-term impact on the market that we can't even fathom right now.
How do you think kind of the development of technologies like autonomous trucking or delivery drones kind of ultimately impact all of this, both in terms of where people live and kind of the adoption of e-commerce?
Well, I think that as people continue to move outside of cities and opt for more land and space than cities and amenities, I think that lends itself to the types of logistical technologies that have been pioneered in China. You know, China's been using drones to, you know, ex-urban regions of their megacities for years now. And we've just now gotten there. You know, companies like Tractor Supply are just now learning how to get tools and supplies and food stores to rural areas in the same day. And this is 2020. So as we continue to sort of democratize commerce in both suburban, ex-urban, and rural areas, yes, of course, we're going to become a lot more comfortable relying on e-commerce as the primary source of retail.
So, you know, there always seems to be in the media world a lot of doubt around, you know, what kind of business model can work today. And then you went ahead and started a company, you know, in the subscription space. What made you think that would work? And do you think that works mainly for sort of niche publications that have a really specific expertise? Or could that be the future for really big kind of mainstream media outlets too?
Listen, I'm not very bullish on it being the solution for big mainstream media sources. For companies like 2PM, it's a subscription-based company, but you know, I'm building a community of sorts, and I know that gets tossed around so much, but we have an actual community. It's not cheap. It's $1,200 a year. It's essentially a think tank of a lot of the best thinkers in and around commerce, retail, media, branding, and you know, data science, and it's wonderful. That's sort of the top level sort of approach that I have for 2PM. But even the mid tier, you know, we are very community driven. I make sure that there's one-on-one connection. If they need something, they can email me. I host dinners quite frequently, obviously before COVID, but that's spinning up again in November. And that's not easily executable by large companies. I think the largest company that could get away with doing something like that would be The Information.
But you also, they deliver a really good product, right? I'm always happy to pay. I think my subscription actually re-upped today. I noticed it. I got like a forum letter from Jessica Lesson saying that. But they deliver a really good product. So when you see mainstream media outlets, maybe it's not subscription-wise, but they kind of really retreat into a, hey, we are the conservative, we are the progressive. You know, the New York Times sort of firing its op-ed page people after they ran an op-ed from Tom Cotton, or Fox News generating higher broadcast ratings than the network. Evening News, what's the play for them there? Is it just that people want to hear the same message they already think kind of reinforced, and advertisers, and that's attractive to advertisers? Like, it seems like they're kind of almost reducing their, you know, their customer base, but yet they all seem to be doing it. Why is that?
You know, I think that they're mostly just experimenting at this point. When it comes to media, what you tend to see is if someone pursues a model, everyone pursues that model, at least an attempt, right? We saw the same thing with affiliate marketing. Mm-hmm. It went from, you know, my former employers, Gear Patrol and Uncrate, to, you know, The Strategist and BuzzFeed, you know, Ben Kaufman's efforts, on down to Business Insider. You know, it's right. Just everyone tries it because that's what people are doing and they're trying to see what works for them. I think that you have to be very committed to it. I think that you have to be willing to grow very slowly and organically. You can't game the system. If you look at The Athletic, they made it a point to drive growth no matter what. And so, yes, they have, I want to say, millions of subscribers now, but they still haven't reached profitability.
Yeah. They took a very venture-like model. I mean, I actually like the product as a sports fan, but it was a venture-like model very much.
Right. Right. But to do things the traditional way, the way that I'm doing it, or the way that at a larger scale Jessica Lesson is doing, or, you know, you can name a number of them at this point. The Hustle has a product that's probably a 7-figure product. You know, they're all profitable. It just takes a long time to do it. And that's why I just have my head down doing the work and hoping that, you know, repetition over time sort of, you know, begins to, unlock the seal.
Did you think there's a world where it makes sense for a venture model to invest in media, or the two things kind of just too binary to succeed? And do you think, you know, the earliest investors in BuzzFeed advice will be happy, but kind of the Series C investors in BuzzFeed advice, even they kind of shake their heads and regret what they did?
I do think that they have some regret. You know, you can look at Vice and Vox and a few others like that. Nothing against them. I typically think that you have to grow slowly when you're building a community, when you're building an audience. And so in my model, yeah, I've turned down venture capital a few times, mainly because I don't want to be on the hamster wheel and I don't want to answer to someone telling me that I need to grow faster, because I spent a lot of time experimenting with new things. And if one quarter's experiment goes wrong and I'm zinged for it, it can be demotivating, you know, which I'm sure sounds a little bit sensitive, but it's a very sensitive business. If you're in the business of subscriptions and unsubscriptions, everything that you do is a test. And it's not a volume play for the vast majority of us. So we have to be willing to take chances. And those chances are a lot less tolerable when you have millions in venture capital backing you.
Right. And do you think media is its own unique universe, or do you think it really is a proxy for the economy more broadly, in the sense of, you know, the lesson of WeWork and Uber and a lot of others is growth at all costs isn't necessarily a good business strategy?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I don't think that it's a proxy for the larger economy. I think that the vast majority of Americans don't consume media the way that the Twitter/internet bubble does. And so I don't think that it's indicative of the larger economy. I think that you have quite a few media groups pursuing the same consumer in different ways. And it becomes a battle of business model and a battle of stickiness. And so for me, it's the reason why I'm focused on a niche is because all I really care about is a specific vertical of people. And I don't anticipate that it's going to get much bigger than that vertical of people. But again, if you've raised venture capital, you're not allowed to have a vertical.
You have to eventually every own vertical. Yeah.
You have to eventually own all of it. And I'm just not interested in that.
Yeah. All right. So last question. So it's we're in the year 2020. You know, you called e-commerce still mainly in a kind of upper middle class and up activity. You know, what year is it when it's sort of the mainstream of how, you know, more than 50% of Americans shop?
50%?
Yeah.
Well, let's be very specific. If it's at 50% of all retail, it will depend on whether or not we truly have the type of second wave that they saw in 1918 or not. If they do, and we're, you know, in quasi lockdown for the next 6 months, you know, as the weather continues to cool off and restaurants close and all that, then yeah, we'll probably get up to close to 40% by the end of February, March.
Right, right.
But if we don't do that and we have sort of a derivative of where we are right now, where things are quasi back to normal, then you're probably looking at 50% in 5 to 6 years.
Got it.
Whereas we were supposed to reach 30% in 10 years prior to COVID.
Right. So it really is, you know, in 100 years, assuming we're still alive and around as people, this will get looked at back as one of sort of the main motivating and kind of influencing factors in the development of e-commerce kind of in the 21st century.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. All right. Well, at least we're living in interesting times. So, Webb, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate
it. Bradley.
Okay, so I guess we've got some minor news. We're starting a bookstore. I guess, means me. And why is a good question. And so far, most people that I've mentioned it to have looked at me like I'm a little crazy. But decided to do it for a few reasons. The first is, you know, I love books. I read a ton. We created the Gotham Book Prize this summer, as our podcast listeners know from all those interviews that we did with the jury. And I always thought it'd be fun to own a bookstore. And I was literally sitting at home one day reading a book and thought, I don't have to wait till I'm 70 or something like that to start a bookstore. I can start one right now. I'm lucky enough to have the money to do it. And, you know, hopefully we won't lose money. But even if we do, luckily I can afford it. I love books. So why not do it? So we are. And it's probably a crazy thing to do right now. A lot of the responses I got from people are like, you know, it's 2020, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm aware of pandemic, you know, global recession, all kinds of bad things. And, you know, doing it, you know, here in New York City, we've got a location in the East Village that we're excited about and can talk about soon. But maybe crazier to do it in New York, because I've been pretty public in saying that I don't think New York is necessarily going to come back from all the impacts of COVID. And I do think that a lot of office jobs will disappear for good, and that will really drain the tax base and the economy. And so it may be really crazy to not believe in the economic future of a city and at the same time decide that you're going to spend your own money opening up a retail business. But at the same time, if anyone needs it right now, it's New York. A million people have been laid off since COVID started. And while this bookstore is only going to employ 6 or 8 people, it's 6 or 8 jobs that didn't exist before. And, you know, if there's a way to show like, hey, I love the city and I want to make a commitment to it and do whatever I can to help it survive, then this is the time to step up. And so we thought it'd be kind of a fun occasional segment to do as part of the podcast, just to talk about how the process works. And, you know, over the next few months, we'll report on our progress. We'll talk to people involved in the project, an architect, a broker, people on our team. I think we'll talk to people who will tell me what a terrible idea this is. And I'm sure we'll talk to some people, hopefully, who love books and think that this actually makes sense. And we'll go through what's working, what's not. I assume we'll have all kinds of trials and travails and problems with permits and construction delays and everything else. But at least we'll get a good sense of what it's like to create a retail business in this environment. And, you know, see what new ideas come out of it. We'll have new ideas. Some of you may have ideas that you could send in to us. Megan's already talking about building a podcast studio on the mezzanine level of the store. And so there's all kinds of cool stuff we can do. Yoni on our investment team already has the event space program for 50 different tech meetups and events and activities. So I'm excited about this. I very well may fail That's okay. I'm luckily in a position that if I do fail, it's not the end of the world. But it takes a thing that I love in books and a city that I love in New York and tries to marry them in a way that hopefully does some good. We'll see if it works, but excited to talk to you guys about it over the next few months.